Ohio State Affairs Committee. And this morning, we will once again be taking up the House Joint Resolution Number 6, which is proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to the Office of Attorney General. And the question being, should we or should we not elect the Attorney General? Of course, Attorney General is appointed now. So, Reverend Carver, would you come back up for just a second and introduce this, and then we'll call a couple of previous Attorney Generals. Could you give us a bring us up to date where we left off, and any other comments you'd like to make at this time? Then we'll go to people who graciously agreed to come in and talk to us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. You know, we've discussed this pretty much at length so far, but we've had some real interesting reading presented to us about what the discussion was during the Constitutional Convention. I thought it was illuminating, and if I had been there at the Constitutional Convention, I might have changed my mind, because at the time, it seemed that what everybody was pretty much agreed on, that they wanted a very, very strong executive branch and a strong governor, and that they didn't want any discordance in the administration. Well, I just happened to be of the belief that Alaska has grown up, times have changed, and we don't need an executive that has no checks or balances on him within the administration. I believe that the Attorney General should be an independent office from the governor, that he shouldn't have to serve at the pleasure of the governor. If he makes a decision that is not in accordance with the governor's wishes, he could be fired. I don't believe that's right. And you brought some folks here that are going to be able to speak at length and eloquently on their experience as Attorney General. So I'd be happy to listen to them. I just don't quite agree that you know, the Attorney General should be only the governor's lawyer. I believe that it's the people's lawyer.
I see. Thank you very much. And before I go on, I'd like to do it, I'd like to call the roll. We have with us this morning Representative Dahl, Representative Cargo, Representative Grinberg, Representative Johnson, Representative Johansson, and Vice Chair Representative Bob Roses. So thank you very much, Representative Carver. What did I do wrong?
Sit in yourself.
Oh, and myself. I'm here too. Some people say not all here, but I am all here. Okay. We have, it was suggested that we try to contact previous Attorney Generals to give us an insight, because nobody probably understands this better than those who served in the high office of Attorney General, however they happened to get there. And many have served with distinction, and many have served, and some have served with less distinction. But I've had my office attempt to contact everybody who served previously as Attorney General. Because of time constraints, we were unable to send a letter out to everybody, and some of them have, in fact, left the state or are no longer with us. But we were able to, so my committee aide made telephone calls as many as she could contact, and we do have at least two previous Attorney General with us this morning. So I'm going to go first to the Attorney General online, and that's Mr. Charlie Cole. And Mr. Cole, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Welcome, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us. Would you give us your name and what you're doing now, if I may ask, and also the years that you served under which governor that you served, or governors that you served?
Well, first let me say preliminary, I'm here, but I'm not sure I'm all here.
Well, we have something in common.
But beyond that, of course, my name is Charles E. for Edward Cole, C-O-L-E. I'm a practicing attorney now in Fairbanks, Alaska. I served as Attorney General under Governor Hickel beginning in December of 1990 and until January of 1994, as I recall. That's my background.
Thank you very much. And You know the topic before us, should we or should we not elect an attorney general? And from the testimony you've heard so far, it looks almost like, excuse the term, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's quite an interesting question. So would you give us your insight on that, please?
Well, let me say preliminarily that it's very important, I think, that the state have as its attorney general the most qualified person it can find to serve in that position. The Attorney General of Alaska is a very important office in state government. It has almost constitutional powers derived from the common law. It represents the state as a plaintiff in civil actions and as a defendant in civil action. And very importantly, it's in charge of essentially all felony criminal prosecutions in the state, from Ketchikan to Barrow, Kotzebue, and that person appoints not only members of the Department of Law, but also the district attorneys throughout the state. So it's a very important office in our state government and rises to a level, I think, substantially higher than those of particular of commissioners themselves. I come down on both sides. It's not an easy decision. I think I come down slightly in favor of the appointed attorney general, but let me tell you why. First, the advantage of an elected of attorney general, it's in furtherance of the democratic process. The people of the state are able to decide whom they want to serve as their attorney general. Mm-hmm. Number one, that's a big plus. Secondly, another big plus, as you've mentioned, is that the attorney general as an elected officer is essentially free of control from the executive branch of government. But there are a lot of disadvantages to that system. First, the most qualified person whom we might find to serve in that position may not want to run for political office, just as a matter of wanting to run for elective office. That's a significant factor. Those of you who run for elective office are aware of the trepidations about running for elective office, number one. Number two, running for elections is costly, as you all know, and you have to seek often contributions, and if the elective attorney general would therefore be looking for contributions for his political campaign, and the question is, from whom does he or she take that money that causes conflict problems? It's a factor, I think, that's significant. Second, if the attorney general does not serve well and he or she is elected, essentially you can't say, I think we'll replace the attorney general. The attorney general is there for the term of the elected office. Often the attorney general who is elected has aspirations for higher political office, elective political office, and maybe the decisions are less than straight down the line for what they would otherwise be absent that consideration. Next is the problem. Attorney general who's elected with office and is in conflict with a governor, and the governor wants to do one thing, and the attorney general, for whatever reasons, decides to do something else. That's not good. Obviously, it doesn't further good representative government. And also, as you well know, there's a tendency for elected attorney generals to be making decisions as attorney general for more political interest than otherwise an appointed attorney general might do. So those are, in my view, the pluses and minuses of that job. But what about the appointment of attorney general? Well, that's a problem, too, and as has been mentioned. First, I think that Whether the system works depends largely on the governor's decision about whom to appoint to that office, and also, obviously, who is appointed. Because, you know, I took the view that the attorney general was the attorney for the people of this state, and not necessarily, essentially not, period, the lawyer for the governor. And when you have an elective appointive attorney general, you know, there are just this tension in there about what I call the third floor, or we all call the third floor, the executive branch of government, telling the attorney general what to do. And that is a problem. And it takes a lot of high integrity by the governor and the attorney general in discharge of the office of the attorney general. Because, you know, you get in the position where the governor say, well, let's take a tax case, for example. Here's the attorney general with the statutory power to settle tax claims. The attorney general says, well, I've looked at this case, and I want to, I think we should settle it for $50 million. Well, then, you know, you get the commissioner of the Department of Revenue says, that's a lousy settlement. Well, you know, I don't want, that case shouldn't be settled for that amount. Well, then where does the problem develop? Well, it rises, you know, to the, and put in the lap, essentially, if the attorney general is appointed to the governor's office. In some ways, you get down, the attorney general says, look, this case should be settled. The commissioner of revenue says it shouldn't be settled. So with the appointed attorney general, you know, it's very, very possible. Well, what really happens, I think, is the governor makes that decision. Now, if you have an elective attorney general, the attorney general makes that decision. You know, he says, I don't care what the commissioner of revenue says. I'm the attorney general. I don't take my orders from the governor. And I'm going to settle this case for, you know, whatever she thinks the case should be settled for. And so that problem is one that rises constantly, I think, in all sorts of decisions involving the discharge of the attorney, the appointed attorney general's decision. Well, you have the same problem now, in a sense. Who should make the decision as to whether the state should file suit against the holders of oil and gas leases on the North Slope for failure to abide by the implied covenant to develop those leases? Well, should the governor make that decision, essentially, or should that decision solely be made by an elective attorney general? That gives you an example of the tension that arises. Now, the governor, I think, has to respect the decisions and integrity of the attorney general in making those decisions. And if the attorney general says, no, I don't think we should file that lawsuit, we've looked into it in the Department of Law, and then the governor's office says, well, I want you to file a lawsuit, well, what happens? You know, difficult problem. So there you are. I'm just sort of saying, you know, the attorney general, the governor really ought to, must, I think, respect the decisions of the attorney general in matters of law and let it lie there. On the other hand, the attorney general has to respect, in some ways, the considerations of the governor's and its desire to effectuate, you know, the governor's political philosophy. And, you know, it gets down to the point at some level where the attorney just has to say, I'm sorry, but I think I can't do it, and asked to do it, I think I'll just leave government service. That's the problem. So, that's all I have to say, I guess.
I want to thank you very much for those comments. That must be, being Attorney General must be a more difficult job than being a representative or perhaps even being the governor. I'm going to go around the table here and see if anybody would like to ask him some questions. Then I'm going to do something a little bit unusual, perhaps, but that's my prerogative. I'm going to ask you, Representative Crawford, the prime sponsor of this bill, if you'd like to ask him some questions. So who had to hand up? Representative Grunberg had a question. How many questions you got there?
20.
20? Can be limited to about 10.
No. General Cole, how are you this morning?
Well, I'm well, thank you.
Been a long time. Glad to have you here.
It's nice to see you back in government service.
Well, we appreciate your advice. I'm going to ask you some questions on a subject that hasn't been broached before in these hearings, and that's the interrelationship between, and I don't mean to catch you cold, and I'll ask General Cole, General Botello the same questions, and anybody else who dares to venture an opinion. We've talked last time about the interplay between the Attorney General's duties and the code of professional responsibility that lawyers have to follow. And that's looking at it from one side of the coin. I'm going to ask you today, General Cole, about the interplay between the duties and potential conflicts of the Attorney General's office and the Alaska Executive Branch Ethics Act. And I'd like to quote from at least...
What? I think this could be a good question where you've got to be very careful where we go with this, because I don't want to bring any actions or perceived actions of previous Attorney General into this direct discussion.
No.
So please proceed, but proceed cautiously.
But I can always take the fifth, I think.
I've never known to.
And that's an Attorney General's prerogative, I guess.
I won't proceed recklessly here. Okay. There's a statute, AS 39.52.160, entitled Improper Representation. And I'm going to read sub A2. A public officer, and I think that would include the Attorney General, may not represent, advise, or assist a person in any matter pending before the administrative unit that the officer serves if the representation, advice, or assistance is without compensation but rendered to benefit a personal or financial interest of the public officer. And would this provide some contour, do you believe, to the limits of the Attorney General's potential conflict if the governor wanted the AG to do something that was contrary to the public interest but designed solely to benefit the governor? Would you care to comment on that?
No. I would really want to see and study that statute and just give a sort of an off-the-cuff opinion in these circumstances. I don't think would be fair to anyone.
Thank you.
If I get to be a governor, I may ask you to come back into service. Any other questions? Representative Coghill.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Cole, for coming before the committee. One of the things that kind of tilted me away from election of an Attorney General was not only the contributions, but then kind of the promises that one would have to make along a kind of a campaign trail. It seems to me like they would be kind of framing public policy in an arena where they may be asked later on to adjudicate contrary to those public policies. Can you wander into that, how that might look in a public policy debate over getting into the legal questions?
Well, I don't think that, you know, any candidate for an elective attorney general, I think, would surely hope have the good sense to not make any policy commitments during the election any more than probably one running for legislative office would. That's what I think about that. One of the problems, you know, we have in this state, which is slightly different than in other states, it's a small state, you know, and attorneys who represent people over a course of time in this state, you know. Have a bunch of problems with conflicts because they've dealt with so many different people or companies over the course of time. It's a bit of a problem, first for elective attorney general and as an appointed attorney general. So I just throw out that particularly problem we have in this state. And I don't know which side that comes down on, elective or appointed.
Thank you, Representative Cogger. Had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, General. I guess what I'm trying to drill down into, because I'm somewhat sympathetic to an election. In fact, I proposed a bill to do that some years ago, so that shows my sympathy. But I wandered into it. So do you suppose then that rather than dealing with public policy, it would be a campaign of qualifications plus personality rather than public policy?
Oh, I would think so. Isn't that the way it's likely come down? You know, one of the things about an elective attorney general may be tempted to, you know, be elected because the person is a well-known individual throughout the state and is elected more on the basis of being well-known throughout the state for one reason or another, rather than on the ability to serve as attorney general. That's a problem, you know. If the attorney general is appointed, there is a greater likelihood that someone who is, you know, well qualified to serve as attorney general, and that is not simply on the basis of legal ability and legal skills, but on the basis of making sound, you want to call, policy decisions or political decisions. You know, the person who serves in that position should be not only on a well qualified lawyer to make the final decisions regarding matters of strictly, you might say, law affecting the state, but also, you know, have a sense of political decisions as well, because, you know, that's just sort of what the Attorney General does in good part.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Grunberg?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Another provision in the Executive Ethics Act, AS 39.52.120, subsection A3, prohibits a public officer from using state time to benefit their personal or financial interests. And sub 5 says that a public officer may not attempt to benefit a personal or financial interest through coercion of a subordinate or require another public officer to perform services for the private benefit of the public officer at any time. Do you see that providing any protection, either of those provisions providing any protection for an attorney general who is asked by the governor to perform an improper service, legal service, or pursue an improper legal course of action?
Yes.
Do you care to comment further?
Well, no, I just on the basis of what the statute says, the attorney general can rely on that. But, you know, it just doesn't work if the attorney general tells the governor, I'm relying on this statute. I mean, that relationship between the attorney general and the governor in an appointive method just has to be better than that. I mean, you know, I think they just have to respect each other's prerogatives and powers. And, you know, the governor has to say when the attorney general says, look, I mean, we just can't do it, and I can't do it in good faith. The governor has to say, I accept that, and, you know, and respect the attorney general's decision. But one of the problems is it's not just the problem arises between the governor and the attorney general. It's other people than the executive branch, the chief of staff, you know. Understandably says, well, we appointed that guy or that lady, and you know, how come he or she's not doing what we want him to do? Well, you know, and then some commissioner goes to the chief of staff and says, you know, what's this attorney general doing here anyway? And the governor has to back up the attorney general in that relationship. And it's just very important that others in the executive branch don't get the idea that because they appointed the attorney general that they can tell the attorney general what to do, quote, at the end of the day. You know, and furthermore, the attorney general has to be strong enough to say, hey, look, you know, I'm the attorney general. I'm a constitutional officer. I'm the attorney general for the people of this state. And that's my decision, and that's it. You know, now, that's where it sometimes gets. I'm sorry, but that's the fact of the matter when you have an appointed attorney general.
Attorney Gernberg, one follow-up.
General Cole, as a private attorney, does that sometimes happen in private practice too?
Well, somebody as your attorney, you know, wants you to do something in the course of litigation or representation that we lawyers often say doesn't pass the red face test. You just have to tell him no, but it's easier to tell him no. You just say, look, you know, I mean, sorry, I can't do that, and here's the file, and thank you very much, and you part well, and you should get another attorney, maybe one who can do that. But it is just not easy for the attorney, an appointed attorney general to do that. I mean, after all, I mean, the attorney general is a constitutional officer, he's a prominent figure, and, you know, it's just not easy to say thank you very much, but going back to my former life, it's hard.
Yeah, Attorney General Cole, yeah, I just was trying to get at the point that I think most experienced lawyers have had that situation occur more than once and know how to deal with a situation where the client may not be following the correct legal or ethical procedure, and have had some experience in that arena.
That's true, sir.
Yeah, well, you know, I think even elected representatives get into that sometimes where one of our constituents says, I want you to do this or do that, and sometimes you just have to say no because it's not proper, it violates my ethical or philosophical principles, and I'm not going to do it. And I may lose your vote. That's where it has to be.
Yeah.
And so I think anybody in the public eye, you know, had that happen. It happened in private practice, not practice, but in private employment, too, where you work for a corporation, work for somebody, and the boss tells you to do something. And sometimes you may have to just say, no, I'm not going to do it. And I may risk my job doing it, but that's part of it. Representative Rogers had a question.
Thank you very much. Sir, first of all, I want to thank you for your service. And the question I would have would be, As Attorney General, if there are cases that are coming up that the state is going to litigate, it would be the Attorney General's responsibility to assign which attorney within the state would be handling that case. Is that correct?
The answer to that is somewhat yes, but we always had some problems with this. I don't know what they call it, where, you know, some attorneys get some departments, commissioners get the assistant attorney generals assigned to them, and then if you try to take that attorney general, assistant attorney general, over to work on major litigation, they say, well, we're paying for that assistant attorney general and we don't want him going. I always took the position, I'm sorry about that, I wanted to select the most qualified lawyers in the entire department to work on cases of paramount importance to the state, and, you know, I know some of the commissioners didn't like it, and with good reason, you know, with good reason because of the financial relationships, but I just thought it's just too important to the state not to have our first-tier team working on particular matters of litigation. Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, it did, but the reason I asked the question is to really get to the next one. And would it be the Attorney General's prerogative to handle that case if they chose to do so? And if you were an elected official and you knew you were having a re-election coming up and it was a pretty emotional discussion and you knew it was going to get a lot of airtime, would you not then, in the best interest of the state, be the attorney that would handle that? Also happens to coincide with being in your best interest for re-election.
Well, you know, I think I remember something historically. Some attorney general was thought to have done that some 30 years or so ago. That could easily be done, yes, if the attorney wanted to do it. Of course, attorney general runs a little risk. If he loses the case, it might not be good for his re-election campaign. So I guess that's the best answer I can give to that.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on the committee? I'm going to ask Representative Crawford, sponsor of the bill, a couple of questions. Ordinarily, we don't do this, but I have the gavel, so I'm going to let you do it. Representative Crawford, do you have any questions for General Cole?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, watching Attorney General Cole, while he was in office, there was never any doubt in my mind that he was acting as he said, with the state's best interests at heart. He was always an independent voice, and had I had the chance, I would have voted to elect him in a heartbeat, as I would have some of the other attorney generals that we've had. But the other times we've seen attorney generals that would have they actually filled a position that was more like the chief of staff than the attorney general. And had I been assured that by getting an appointed attorney general, we'd get one like Attorney General Cole each time, I wouldn't be here this morning. But he's made the point, I believe, made it very well for me that the way we've set it up here, any attorney general has some loyalty to the governor. And I come down on the other side that the attorney general should be independent, should be the people's top lawyer. He should be able to give the governor opinions, but no more to the governor than he should to the people or to the legislature or to anybody that is a citizen of this state.
Is there a question in there someplace? Or?
No, I just I really think that this is one of those questions that is neither all right or all wrong on either side. And arguments can be made for either side. I just happen to come down on the side of a more democratized. I don't know what the proper word.
We know what you're saying. Democratic.
Democratic.
Small D.
Yeah.
One more. Reverend Grunberg had. He's going to pass me a note here. Someday I may collect all the notes I get in the legislature and sell them.
Mr. Chair?
I have a note from Representative Grunberg, and it says, would General Cole like to respond?
To that comment?
Yes.
Well, I guess no more than I can always I just reflect back, you know, I heard over the radio not so long ago, sort of where it works elsewhere, Governor Schwarzenegger asked or directed the Attorney General of the state of California to file some lawsuit or take some action. And the Attorney General said, you forget, Governor, I'm elected. I'm not taking my orders from you. I thought I would really like to talk to the former Attorney General of California who told that to Governor Schwarzenegger, because it just sort of highlighted, the issues that we have here in the appointee of attorney general situation. It's just not easy. And I say it, if the appointed attorney general is going to work, it just depends highly on the integrity of both the governor and the attorney general. That's the only way it can work. And one may say, you know, that's a pretty risky situation to, but on the other hand, that's why we elect the governor and rely on the governor to discharge those responsibilities with full integrity.
It that happens, Greg, at separation of powers and who elects whom. And so I've had the opportunity to tell a previous governor that I did not work for him. So I'd like to thank you very much, Reverend Cole. General Cole. Any other questions? Thank you very much, and again, we appreciate your service to the state of Alaska and wish you well, and I would be very happy to meet you someday.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for calling in. Okay, we have former Attorney General Bruce Patello in the audience. Would you care to join us, please, sir?
Can I make some comments before I start? So yeah. I don't have to interrupt you.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask if Reverend Rhoda has any comments he wants to make, as he has to leave us here soon. And if you'll excuse me for just a moment.
Please. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I didn't want to interrupt Mr. Patello once he started. I do have another meeting that I have to go to at 9, and so I don't know whether you're planning on passing this out of committee or not, but I wanted to make some final arguments. And we've been having some considerable discussions in resources on a very small item to the state. I think it's called a GIA, which has definitely the most profound impact on our future than any other bill that we're working on, including this one. And I think the fact that the Attorney General is appointed and does make our executive branch stronger, and we've had some comments made that, you know, maybe 30 years ago, 50 years ago, that we needed that strength because we were a new state and we're having to go up against the federal government on issues, and we needed that strong executive branch and felt that maybe that wasn't quite as necessary now as it used to be. Well, I happen to believe that it's just as strong, if not stronger. We have a little action going on the outer continental shelf with some leases that have been let go. And if those are outside the 3 to 6 mile limit, there is no tariff on that, any gas that's produced that's then injected into the pipeline. So it becomes the responsibility of the state of Alaska to negotiate with the federal government over whether they're going to share their tariffs with us or not. Sounds to me like we need a very strong executive branch. And so I have some real concern over that. The other concern I have about electing as opposed to appointing, we probably would have to have some very strict guidelines in terms of what the qualifications would be. Otherwise, what stops us from electing a very charming, very vibrant personality of somebody that has very little experience as an attorney? You know, when I want somebody representing me and giving me best legal advice, I do not run around and find the most charming person I can find. I want somebody with lots of experience, lots of talent, and lots of knowledge. And unfortunately, what happens in a campaign, the person that is the best salesman, the one has the best personality.
That's how I got it.
Sometimes wins. I know that, and I was thinking of you as I spoke. You were going to be my example, but you can take care of that. And so, as you know, I want somebody that has the knowledge and experience, and I think electing somebody doesn't necessarily guarantee that for us. And I will agree, appointing doesn't always do that either. But I think you have then provided an opportunity. I don't know of a single person running for elected office that the first thing they say is, boy, I really don't want to be successful at this. You know, if you're going to run for governor, you want to be successful. Your intention of running was to accomplish an objective, to do what you could for the citizens of the state of Alaska and move forward what you think is the best plan to get there. So why would you go out and pick somebody that you didn't think was the best attorney general to help you get there? And so I have some real reservations about politicizing a position of that magnitude. And there's been some discussion around this table, okay, well, let's put it where they would run on a ticket with the governor and lieutenant governor. The minute you do that, what happens if that attorney general quits? You're back to having somebody appointed again. I mean, I don't see how we've necessarily made the process any better. I think we've actually, in my opinion, have encumbered the process. I think we, as soon as you make it political, you enter into a whole other area of dynamic over which a lot of people have no control. And as Attorney General Cole said, there's an awful lot of people that would make fabulous attorney generals, have no interest whatsoever in running for a political office. And so, those of us that have done it, you know how things get misconstrued, misrepresented, lies are told about you that, well, does it have an appearance that it could possibly be true? Yeah. You know, I could have at one point in time maybe speeded, and I maybe did break the law. I just happened not to get caught at it. You know, fact of the matter is, I just think it makes it very cumbersome, very awkward, and I quite frankly don't think it leads us down the path to getting the best representation that we would or could have. So that's my opinion, and I hope that whoever we decide, if we go to an election, has the personality of our chair.
And you can remain as vice chair of this committee. Thank you very much, Representative Rogers. With that, I would like to welcome Mayor Vitello here, and please give us your official name, title, and when you served as Attorney General, and for what governor, which governor you served with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bruce Vitello. I appear today as a private citizen, not in my capacity as mayor of the city and borough of Juneau. I served as Attorney General from January 1994 through December 2002. I had the distinct honor of serving as Charlie Cole's Deputy Attorney General. I want to say at the outset, he is a person for whom I have the highest admiration. I think he is the epitome the kind of attorney general that any state deserves. And I subscribe fully to virtually every statement that he made, which I think emphasizes that this is not a clear-cut decision one way or another. And I think he also underscored, I would, having observed firsthand some of the decisions he had to make, some of the difficulties that confront an attorney general who is appointed by a governor. There are numerous occasions, virtually all of which went unnoticed in the public, would not have been a matter of public record, where Charlie Cole would put his job on the line, basically saying, this is the line, I can't cross it, I won't cross it. And I would say in most instances, all instances, either the governor or the respective executive branch agency official respected that decision, or at least backed down. So there's clearly that tension. I think both Representative Crawford and, in greater to lesser degree, reflected in the questions here, the fundamental issue of whether you elect an attorney general or not is simply your view about the allocation of power within the executive branch. And generally speaking, those who support the election of attorney general are folks who hold the view that the executive power is too concentrated in the governor, that the attorney general is not in a position to exercise independent judgment on legal matters that affect the executive branch, and that position should one be one that serves as a check on the power of the governor. And on the other hand, I think those who support the view that an appointed attorney general makes most sense, and reflected, I think, in the constitutional debate, I have not been part of your earlier hearings, but I'm sure the history was reviewed with you. Territorial days, the attorney general was the highest elected official in the territory. But the view that it was important, not only with regard to the attorney general, but other boards and commissions we had, that we consolidate the power of the executive branch into one elected official, that being the governor. And our Constitution reflects the executive power being vested in the governor, that one does not want to disperse the decisions on policy, including legal policy, to more than the one person elected, in essence, to speak for the people of the state. Now, most states elect their attorneys general. 43 of the 50 states do. There are five states who have the governor make the appointment. Maine has the legislature make that appointment. Tennessee's attorney general is actually selected by the Supreme Court. It reflects in part the fact that we do have lots of different dynamics and cultures within our various states, truly the test tube of our democratic system. And as we look at the history of the office around the country, we'll find that most of these elected attorney general positions are a result in part of Jacksonian movement, where there was a double concern, one about diffusion of power, not wanting to concentrate it, and second, accountability, so that in many of the states you had numerous public officers that were independently elected by the people, and the Attorney General office was one of those. And we also saw a movement, particularly following the Civil War and into the late 19th century, of other constitutional reforms, most of which ended up looking at an elected AG position. Not to spend too much time on this, but it's also interesting to note that there were several states that didn't create the Office of Attorney General for 30, 50 years, until 30, 50 years after achieving statehood. And there are states that had the office, abolished it, and then established them again. If you look at the five states that have an appointed attorney general by the governor, what is interesting to note is that three of them, Alaska, Hawaii, and New Jersey, really reflected a change of view, that is, towards the consolidation of power, and are the reflection of more modern thought about government and the idea of consolidating power in an executive. New Jersey had gone through a major constitutional revision in 1949, and that was inspiration in part for work done on the Alaska Constitution, and also Hawaii. So again, of the five states that have the governor appointed, they're also some of the most recent constitutional reforms. Regardless of where, in what state we're talking about, there are some common denominators about the functions of the office. And generally speaking, we look to the attorney general to be the chief legal officer of the state, to be the person who is in control of litigation involving the state. Almost all attorneys general have some criminal law jurisdiction, although it varies from state to state, and I'll get into that in a moment. The power of public advocacy, the power of issuing opinions to state agencies, legislative advocacy and drafting, which is a function that's, again, a key in this state. And most every state has also taken on the function of consumer protection in the office itself. Alaska is fairly unique in at least one circumstance. I think only with Delaware, where criminal jurisdiction is vested in the Attorney General, both at the trial and appellate level. Delaware is the only other state where the Attorney General appoints district attorneys and has direct control over it. And so, in some respects, the power of the Attorney General in the state is much greater than in most others. Let me get to my recommendation, and in doing so, simply expand again on reasons that I think speak in favor of an elected attorney general: the sense of more direct accountability to the people, the ability to stand up to the governor, and again, it ties back to the sense of greater independence, the ability to campaign on legal policies as opposed to that otherwise wouldn't generally come up in the course of a gubernatorial race. I believe Representative Grunberg was asking, what do you campaign on? And very frequently, themes dealing with consumer protection, consumer fraud, protecting of senior citizens, protecting of children, are themes that will come up in races, not so much in terms of what the legal policy should be in particular cases, But overall, what are the things I, if I were running for office, would emphasize? Here are the drawbacks, and it's the reason why I've come to the conclusion that the system we have in place is the better. First, there is the clear risk of conflicts in who sets the policy of the state. And I think that conflict is there whether or not the Attorney General and the governor are of the same party in an elected circumstance. And there have been some major battles over the, I can think even the last decade, between the Attorney General and governor in Mississippi over how tobacco funds should be expended. A similar battle in Utah, which led ultimately the Utah state legislature to accept recommendations of the governor to dramatically reduce the powers of the Attorney General. I think we need to look at some practical things. There would be a need to restructure how legal services are rendered. Most states that have an elected Attorney General do not represent the governor. The governor will have his or her own legal counsel as a consequence. It's a position you need to be thinking about if you decide, and the people decide, that they want this restructuring. Generally speaking, where you have the office of Attorney General that is elected, state agencies who are accountable primarily to the governor would prefer to have their own in-house counsel, and rather than rely on an attorney whose accountability is to that independently elected Attorney General. That's not in every case, but it is an issue that one would need to struggle with as one tries to come up with a workable system in this state. And then I think also touched on earlier, it's just the consequence of having another elected office seeker in the statewide mix, both in terms of the nature of campaigning and what it means in terms of the kind of office one needs to maintain as a political office. Does it mean that the Attorney General would have a public relations arm? I think it would be very difficult not to, and I would tell you that most attorneys general do have people whose responsibility is to do public outreach. But using that word is a nice way of saying PR. Obviously, a certain portion of that staff will also be more concerned about the politics of the position, that is, either looking for re-election or just the opportunity to get the message out. I would say, overall, the appointed Attorney General does not spend a lot of road time campaigning, either in the sense of just making public speeches on various issues. I assure you that it is entirely different than the context of an elected Attorney General who has a need to reach out to constituents across the state.
Mr. Chairman. Reverend Cargill.
Sorry to interrupt with all my apologies to the attorney and to the committee chairman. I have about a 10-minute meeting that I'm going to have to go out on, come back in.
So would you like to make the comments before?
No, I'm actually late right now. So I wanted to hear his comments right up to the last little bit, and I'll be looking forward to the record of some of these. I'll try to be back just as quickly as I can.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, let me just summarize. I think with very few exceptions, an appointed Attorney General has served the state well. And I would say, for the most part, those who have held the office have been very skilled. And I'd also tell you that most would not have, on their own, ever thought to run for public office. And I think Charlie Cole is a good example.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Reverend Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking back on the minutes from the Constitutional Convention, it seems like the question of power that you brought up was really kind of what they spoke about most directly, at least in these minutes on day 53, as far as having the two elected officials and basically watering down. Can you reiterate, is that basically kind of where you're coming from, is the main crux of the issue?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes. I think, stripped of all others, it is simply whether there will be two independent voices within the executive branch determining policy, one theoretically limited to legal policy and the other to more general policy. Unfortunately, there's a great overlap. And if I might just expand, within the National Association of Attorneys General, it is a standing joke that AG really stands for aspiring governor. And there is some truth to that. If I think of the people that I serve with, Christine Gregoire is now the governor of Washington State. Janet Napolitano is the governor of Arizona. Jennifer Granholm is the governor of Michigan. Jim Doyle is the governor of Wisconsin. Elliot Spitzer is the governor of New York. Mike Easley is the governor of North Carolina. Those are colleagues I serve with. So there is some, and of course, not every aspiring governor has actually achieved office, but I make the point that, and in each of those cases, I think they were distinguished attorneys general, and I think distinguished public servants who got there on their merits. But I would also say, in several of those cases, there were also situations where there was direct conflict between the policies of the governor and the attorney general, and it's a subject that within the organization is frequently discussed.
And Representative Johansson first.
Sure, of course.
And just because of your experience in the position, that power that the governor has, as it's set up right now, you know, comes with it, you know, the accountability. I mean, if an attorney general works for the governor, something happens with an attorney general, that obviously reflects off of the person who hired him, along with all the other appointments from every other department, commissioners and such. I guess that's more of a statement than a question, but it's
Mr. Chairman, I would agree.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
I'll yield to Representative
Dahl. Because you're still writing, huh? You're still writing questions. Okay.
Yeah. This is sort of a comment and a question, I think, at the same time. You know, we've had a lot of, as you know, Mr. Botello, we've had a lot of attention paid to ethics over this last year. And because of that, we've had a great desire to be more transparent and to have the public understand more what's going on behind the scenes and so that there's no longer behind the scenes. There's no more closed doors and secretive things and where the public is saying, okay, what's happening next? And for that point, it would seem, and I would like to get your opinion, and you sort of already referred to that, but would it be better, would it open it up more, and we'd do a greater service to the public by having this elected? Therefore, as you say, they do have a department, they would have a Department of Public Relations, but would that be a service to the public to have it open like that?
Mr. Chairman, my sense of the ability of an attorney general to be able to reach out, to do public outreach, has some advantages. I'm not sure it has advantages with respect to the issue of transparency in ethics. That is, I think, somewhat different issue that can be reached by changes to the Executive Branch Ethics Act, decisions about, and I think it's a challenge that you have as the legislative body to weigh issues of privacy about a person who has been, in essence, accused of a violation. At what point should the public be aware of that or the proceedings going about it? Balancing, of course, then the public's right to know, number one, that its government is being responsive, that it is indeed holding its public officials to high standards, and asking for them to be accountable for that. I think that's kind of the dynamic. I think it probably relates less to the question of whether the Attorney General is elected or appointed, but how you structure the Ethics Act itself.
Thank
Member Dahl, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Reverend Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions on several issues, if I might. First, you've given us a list of some of the current governors who were former AGs. How about U.S. senators? I know Senator Lieberman, Senator Bingaman. How many others do you know who were former AGs?
Mr. Chairman, I served with Senator Cornyn from Texas. The junior senator from Arkansas, and I'm now having been put on the spot and blanking out Senator Salazar from Colorado. Those are members who Jeff Sessions.
And probably throughout history, there were more.
Mr. Chairman, that is certainly certainly correct. And again, also in the U.S. House of Representatives, there are several former attorneys general.
Reverend Grunberg?
Thank you. How about people who have in states that elect their Supreme Court justices? Do people who've been attorney general often, or other judges that are elected, do people you know, who have been AGs sometimes run for judicial office then?
Mr. Chairman, decidedly yes. Actually, to take an example, the current governor of Oregon, a former attorney general and also a former elected member of the Oregon Supreme Court, and Senator Cornyn himself, immediately before running as attorney general, had served as an elected member of the Supreme Court of Texas.
If I may follow.
It'd be seen to me there'd be very few attorney generals who later became state house representatives, though.
Mr. Chair, I would like to go there next. You enjoy a distinction that I can see. We've passed out a list that Ledge Research has prepared of all the attorneys general.
And Alaska.
Of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the governors under whom they served. And you enjoy a distinction that I see with only two others, and only three people I can see here who served in elective office. You are now mayor, and you have been in the past in Juneau. John Rader, the first attorney general, became a state senator.
And president of the Senate.
And then president of the Senate. Ralph Moody had been, I think, a territorial and then a state senator before he became attorney general. And I'd like, since you have, and then you're the only of those three people who are witness today, you're in a unique position to talk in terms of the interrelationship between an appointed attorney general and a person who's had the experience and either subsequently or previously of running for office and serving in elective office. Anything else you'd like to talk about from that unique point of view?
Good question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I have much to offer except to suggest that there's one name who needs to be added to that list, presuming that Talis Kohlberg is actually confirmed as Attorney General. He is sitting that. The sitting Attorney General is also a person who has had local elective government experience.
Yeah, he was on the, I believe, Matsu Borough.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
My sense is that the experience of elective office certainly creates a degree of hopefully a political antenna as one tries to provide advice to a governor, for example, but perhaps even lend some credibility in terms of the analysis. My experience, and again, I worked as a career lawyer in the Department of Law as well. I had a chance to work with several governors and several attorneys general, and one of the features that I think is actually a strength of our system, but has its inherent weakness as well, is the relationship between the governor and the Attorney General is the chief legal advisor. Most governors come to rely on their attorneys general for not only legal judgment but political judgment, because very frequently they overlap. And I would also say that there are some governors who come into office not fully appreciating that. It may well be true for attorneys general as well. It is surprising to me at times that some governors have not known their attorneys general at all, but come to very much appreciate the importance of that particular relationship in trying to implement policies that the governor seeks to achieve, and needing legal guidance, because for the most part, major policy initiatives have dramatic legal implications, whether it's with respect to legislation, litigation, or simply direction to the various departments of government.
If I may just...
Sure, of course.
If we were to elect an attorney general, should they be of the same political party, or would it make any practical difference? Same political party as the governor.
Mr. Chairman, my sense is that should largely be irrelevant. If the primary purpose is to be a check on the authority of the governor, I think the political affiliation itself probably will be of lesser import. Obviously, there is the risk that if they are of different parties or have different political views, that there could be greater conflict. But I would also say, again, there are 43 states that are operating on the basis of an independent elected attorney general. And while there are substantial numbers of cases that highlight the both real conflicts that sometimes arise and the mischief that can happen, for the most part, those relationships tend to work out, and that's because one relies on the core of professionals within the departments, whether they're called law or justice, that are serving on a day-to-day basis the agencies and people of the states.
Let me go to him, and then I'll come back. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. I wanted to sneak in while we were talking about that. obviously, being chosen by two separate governors, you're very well respected of all the people that I've talked to. I've been around for quite a while, and you're obviously very, very capable, did a great job. Do you think back when you first became Attorney General or a few years before that, do you think you ever would have become an attorney general if you had to run a statewide campaign for it, from your perspective back before?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I would have considered running for attorney general before my appointment.
If I just jump in, do you think that'll have a real effect on the quality of folks? I mean, I'm not sure about Mr. Kohlberg, but very nice man. I'm sure he's very talented, but I don't really see him going out statewide campaigning just out of the blue. I'm wondering what kind of effect that's going to have on getting quality people who just may not be statewide candidate material.
Mr. Chairman, as I reflected earlier, I think back on the numerous people who since statehood have served as attorneys general, few of them would have run. Most of them were outstanding attorneys general, outstanding lawyers, outstanding people. And I think it's fair to say that several of them would not have run, in part because they have enough self-recognition to know that they're not people who campaign well. And they were selected not because of their campaigning abilities, but because they brought some combination of personal and professional skill, a talent that a governor saw that he or she needed to complement the work that they're hoping to achieve. And that's not to say we haven't had some colorful attorneys general who very much would have run had the had the opportunity been there. I think in particular, and if Charlie's still on, he might have other suggestions, but I think of Edgar Paul Boyko as Edgar Paul Boyko, who in many respects was the most flamboyant attorney general this state has seen, and as Representative Grunberg will recall, was known as the Snow Tiger. And with without being too going into this too far, I would say there was never a headline that he didn't enjoy. That's a risk.
Would knowing what you know now, would you have run for attorney general?
I found
the opportunity not been appointed.
I don't see that in my future. If you were to propose this and it were approved by the public, but I would say that the office of attorney general was most had its very frustrating moments, but probably the most satisfying career experience in my life.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on the very last, you had a, and I don't know if other people have come through the exact career path you did, General Botello, but you were in the Attorney General's office for another, you were Assistant Attorney General, that's what most of the attorneys are, for many years. You were then appointed Deputy, which is the Assistant Attorney General, and then when General Cole left, you were appointed to the position of AG. Had that been elected, you couldn't have run, could you? Because you would have had to quit your state job to run. A state employee can't run for office, so they couldn't be elected directly from an attorney general's position, who may be the most qualified person to seek the office. They'd have to quit that position and be in hiatus for a period of time before they could run, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg's statement is almost entirely correct. One may not run for partisan political office.
Assuming it would be partisan.
Yes, but for nonpartisan positions, members in the department are permitted under our little Hatch Act to do so. I just make that small correction, but certainly for office of Attorney General, a member of the department would be precluded from running unless he or she resigned first.
If I may continue.
That's a very astute question.
There are several areas I'd like to explore if I could. You enjoyed another unique distinction. I think you were probably the longest serving attorney general. And you also had another, from what I can see in this list, unique distinction. You served under a Republican governor and then under a Democratic governor. And in some cases, and I can think of at least two, one being the Katie John case and the other the open primary case, the governors, the administrations, took diametrically opposite positions. And it's normal under the canons of ethics, you can't represent both sides in the same litigation. And you couldn't represent one side of a litigation and then subsequently shift. An attorney general may have to do that, and this is very unique because it would only occur probably in a person like you who was the AG under one administration and then under another, and it would be unlike, I don't know, I suppose it could occur if the AG were elected, but it's more likely to occur if they're appointed. How do you resolve that ethical situation? What do you think?
Mr. Chairman, it, in my view, poses little of an ethical dilemma. The client didn't change. The client was the state of Alaska. The person elected by the public and the office is that of the governor, who gets to set the policy. If the client makes a change in position, and that change is neither in itself unethical or a breach of law. It may be bad policy, But I think where I drew the line, and I think most attorneys general would, is that my job is to give the best advice I can, but to implement governor's directives to the extent that they are consistent with the law. And I would say on more than one occasion, there were circumstances where a governor, my governor, whether Governor Hickel or Governor Knowles, made some policy calls with which I personally disagreed, but which, in my view, were legally sound or legally defensible. Again, choices I would not make were I in their position. They had the right to do it, and they had the right to make sure that we made the best legal case there. Now, I will say that there are points, two points out of it. There are times when the line could be crossed, and then I think the situation is you've got to be prepared to tender your resignation. And former attorneys general in the state have done that. And I think it's reflected in part by the fact that there are relatively few attorneys general who have served full terms with the governors who appointed them.
Very good. Representative Greenberg?
A couple of other areas, and I want to explore some things that we really haven't explored yet. Most attorneys who've thought about it, and maybe the general public, but not as much, realize that attorneys have a number of functions that are not normally listed. Here they are. But they're quite different. Attorneys do research and act as scholars and provide legal advice and counsel, secondly. Sometimes they help in mediating and resolving disputes amicably. Sometimes they eventually become litigators, draftsmen, skilled at drafting documents and interpreting them. An attorney general also, as you mentioned, must be a public advocate sometimes, and particularly must be the top administrator for the department. And actually, when we talked about mediation a minute ago, it's both intra-departmental mediation and mediation among various departments and possibly among external people and the administration who would like the administration to do a certain thing, and there's some question about resolving that. And finally, the question of being sort of a politician. And as the Arledge research said, and I'm looking at page 2 of the memo here, Av Gross said, quote, appointed AGs are lawyers who have an interest in politics, and elected AGs are politicians who are lawyers. That may be a somewhat facile way of putting it, but what I'd like you to do with that laundry list I gave you, and this is a long answer, a long question, may have a long answer too, I'd like you to rank those functions and any others you think of, both from the importance and the amount of time that's consumed for a person who's an elected attorney general as opposed to one who's an appointed attorney general, in order of importance.
Mr. Chairman, my again, not having been an elected attorney general, I'm relying in large part of my anecdotal contacts with colleagues. I think that we, in many respects, share in common most of the same objectives. It is in both the elected and appointed attorney general's interest to make sure it's a well-run office, that services are being provided efficiently and effectively. So that is a theme, but also one that in both instances is fairly delegated to one or more deputies. I note that office management, in fact, was a major issue in the campaign for the Washington governorship with Christine Gregoire over management. My sense would be that one of the areas of distinction is the degree to which work is done behind the scenes as opposed to in a public setting, and the need to create an aura of public prominence. Again, a successful attorneys general and whether they're elected or appointed, I think are usually achieve most of that success in their works within the executive branch. For me, I think a large part of my time was devoted to the very topic that you mentioned, that is the mediation of issues that arose both within the department, but probably more importantly between the departments and the executive branch over, for example, oil and gas policy, where we three departments having some responsibility, tariffs being managed largely by the Department of Law, but the implications both for royalty and taxation, and trying to develop consistent tactics as well as viewpoints on valuation, for example, that where the Departments of Revenue and Natural Resources would have different views. That probably in many respects was a theme that was dominant certainly through most of Charlie Cole's time, mine, and actually, to be honest, in the previous 10 years, the disputes over royalty payments and taxes due to the state consumed a great deal of time. I think in many of the policies that were pursued, we're very interested in mediation with outside parties where we were in litigation. And again, I think it was one of the strengths that Charlie Cole brought to bear in terms of the negotiation of settlements with some of the major oil companies. It's an area that I spend a good deal of time. One thing that's again, looking at my colleagues, elected attorneys general, I think it's fair to say, have generally, when there has been an opportunity to argue a case in front of the United States Supreme Court, almost invariably can't resist the temptation. I think, again, attorneys general in Alaska have had that opportunity several times, and I think our deference has been to making sure we had the best advocate in front of the court to make the case. You know, there is a great photo op. If you're the attorney general and you've argued the case, of course the risk, again, is the outcome. But I use that as, again, maybe an anecdotal differentiation, and I, again, there have been some great advocates, but I also know that in one situation, a close friend of mine in the AG's, who was an AG, devoted literally months to preparation, to the exclusion of almost anything else that was going on in his department. And that, of course, is the kind of devotion one expects for a case in front of the Supreme Court, but it is certainly, I think, conflict in terms of the discharge of other responsibilities. Again, that's just a small fraction of what happens in the normal course, but I think it's illustrative of what I think would be a somewhat different approach by elected as opposed to appointed attorneys general.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And we do have two amendments coming up. I'd like to have a chance to discuss those. Any other questions for
Mr. Chairman? First of all, thank you for excusing me for a few minutes. And if this question was asked.
And you missed some good ones, though, while you were gone.
Yeah, and my apologies. I'm sorry. It's the only time I could get into the third floor. There's probably two areas that that I would be interested in, especially from an opinion of a man who's been involved. Across the United States, the attorneys general have an association, and so there's probably some discussion on Article 10 of the Constitution as to how you assert that, how you work to strengthen the state's rights, if you will. So from your perspective, have the elected attorneys general been so independent that they were had a different view from their governor, or do you think that they were adding to, or was it so mixed that it's hard to tell?
Mr. Chairman, I think issues related to the 10th Amendment and probably most crystallized in the question of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. It was one of those areas that for which there were great tensions. They tended less to break down on a question of either partisanship or elected versus appointed AGs than perhaps what states were most likely to be impacted by Indian gaming, though I think for the most part attorneys general tended to align on one side, which was in defense of state prerogatives in regulating gaming. I mean, there are other issues where they would diverge, and again, there were relatively few issues. Perhaps anything dealing habeas corpus was an area that tended to break down, not so much on, again, elected versus appointed, but over whether one was Republican or Democrat. That occurs and occurred relatively infrequently in the organization. Generally speaking, the National Association of Attorneys General has been very good in trying to keep a non or bipartisan or about it and focusing on the prerogatives of the Attorney General.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
First of all, I'm interested in the state's right issue because I think we have a growing and ever more powerful federal government. So if I thought for a moment that elected attorney general would give us a little more clout, I'd do it in a heartbeat. If I thought that it was a combination of the governor bringing with them an attorney general and it had more clout, that would be the way I'd go. So to me, how do we undergird that is going to be part of my question. And then I think you brought up another issue. We don't have to delve into it, but it could fall into a political dynamic that would be interesting. With the independence of an attorney general and a governor with regard to Indian law in Alaska, because I think that it might have the benefit of bringing more people to the debate. On the other hand, it might divide the executive branch so much that you really would not be able to make forward movement. We're so unique in all the rest of the United States in that regard that it would be my mind just kind of breaks down when I start thinking about what could come of that. But I know that you've been involved in it. So from your perspective, was it, you think it's a cleaner way of taking it as a state policy generally, or do you think that the issue should be broken out more as a political law decision?
Mr. Chairman, my sense is that this is one that there's no real predictor. You've basically got a scenario where you could have a governor taking one position, the say position A, the attorney general taking position B, in an elected situation, or vice versa. What you are, and you may be satisfied with position A or position B. You may have the situation where both accept position A or both accept position B, and you've got to decide. What you are guaranteed in our system is it'll be either A or B, but it won't be a situation where they will be divided.
And only the imagination could work on that, probably.
Thank you. We asked previously, Representative Carver, do you have a specific question you'd like to ask?
I just have one more question.
Quickly, well, I want. We're running out of time. I'd like to consider these two amendments.
Understood. And I'm kind of talking to Representative Crawford as well as General Botello. In informal conversations, Representative Crawford has expressed, at least privately to me, and I hope this is okay to publicize, his concern that. And I think he said this publicly, too.
Yeah, no.
One of his concerns here was that an attorney general who's appointed might feel beholden to the governor and not want to get fired. And if it was an elected position, there'd be more independence. Am I not characterizing that correctly? And I'd like to ask you that directly. What do you think?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a risk. You count, however, on the integrity, as Charlie Cole put it, of both the governor and the attorney general, but at least the integrity of the attorney general to be able to make calls, stand up for them. I would say my first mentor in the Department of Law was a later attorney general, but was deputy at the time I first came onto the department, Wilson Condon. The point he made was, in this department, it was the first message when I came in to the department was, here we call balls and strikes as we see them. And I think that has generally reflected the approach that attorneys general in this state have taken. And again, whatever the consequences. And I would say, for the most part, I think that's what's happened in the department. Not all the balls and strikes are publicly announced. They happen oftentimes in the office of the governor. They may happen in court. They frequently happen, of course, in the context of the decisions being made in advance about whether to prosecute a particular case civilly or criminally, or how that should happen. I think it reflects a general sense of pride within the department that's our job is to call balls and strikes, and in that way that we are serving the people, that the governor is well served, any governor is well served by that same approach. And I will say this, I hope that's the same standard if we have an elected attorney general, and that there's a culture in our departments and in our government that's what we expect, whether elected or appointed.
I'd like to thank you very much for your testimony. It's been a very fascinating discussion, both with you and General Cole. I think it's really helped us understand the issue and the public who's watching this on gavel to gavel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And is there anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? If not, I'll close public testimony. And before we go to discussion, Representative Crawford, you had a comment?
If I could just make another statement. It doesn't have to be now.
Well, let's take care of these amendments before we do that, if you would. So with that, before we go to committee discussion and maybe a wrap-up by Representative Crawford, I'd like to consider, we have an amendment number one for Representative Dahl. Would you move that amendment?
I make a motion to move amendment number one.
Is there any objection?
I'll object so we can discuss it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, will you speak to your objection, please? Or present the amendment?
What I would like to do is I'd like to hear the presentation.
Yeah. Would you present the amendment?
Thank you. This has to do with...
A little louder, please.
Yes, this has to do with the terms of office. And what I am suggesting here that we look on page 2, line 5, where it states there shall be no limit on the terms of the Attorney General, and we would insert a new subsection to read, no person who has been elected Attorney General for two full successive terms shall be again eligible to hold that office until one full term has intervened. So what I'm proposing here is a term of office.
Reverend Coghill?
This falls along the same line, I think, as the term for the governor, true?
Right.
And it might answer part of the question on what do you do when you have a continuous election cycle and you have an attorney general continually running. However, both with the governor and with the attorney general, you might find that you have an excellent advocate that you must vacate. And as with the legislature, we don't have term limits at this point. And it's been my experience that there's been significant enough turnover to keep us from having that
becoming stagnant.
Right. I think the fact that you'd be up for election on a regular cycle under this, I don't know that I would agree with that kind of a limit. But I've also heard testimony that there are several places where the Attorney General, it's hard to get rid of. Is that the people's fault or the Attorney General's fault? I think that rests in the people. But history in Alaska said that once you had an attorney general, which was at that point one of the more powerful offices, that they were reluctant to turn away a good attorney general. And before I'm willing to vote for this, I think I would want to go back and review some of that history. I think that we had a strong governor, but was appointed from the feds, and the attorney general then. Am I wrong in that? We had an election of a governor at that point, too.
Oh.
It was an appointment, right?
Right.
Right. So I think in this particular case,
the Attorney General, Mr. Chair, the Attorney General was the highest
right.
state elected office, as I recall.
That's what I recall, too. I was just doubting my memory. What if they wanted to change governors but not attorney general? That could be an interesting debate. So I'm going to maintain my objection and probably vote against it at this point.
Any other questions on this? We have withdraw the amendment or withdraw the objection? Reverend Grunberg, we have to move along here.
I understand. I usually very much respect Representative Dahl, but in this particular case, for the reasons expressed, and because we have a relatively small bar, we have some 3,500 people in the bar. It used to be, when I started 30 years ago, maybe 1,200 people in the bar, but it's still pretty small, and not that many people are willing to go and run for public office. And so I'm reluctant to support the amendment for that reason.
Any other comment? If not, I'd like to remain in objection. Want to call the roll?
Representative Grunberg?
No.
Representative Dahl?
Yes.
Representative Roses, not present.
Excused also. Yeah, he's not present, but he's also excused.
Thank you. Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Johansson?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Chair Lynn?
Yes.
Two yay, four nay.
Okay, two nays, no. Two yeas, four nays. So amendment number one has failed. Amendment number two, Representative Johnson, would you move that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this brief. Basically what...
First you have to move it.
I'd like to move amendment two.
I'll object so that we can hear it, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Sorry to hear that, Representative Coghill. amendment two basically...
This is not an objectionable question.
I understand that. Amendment two basically requires that the Attorney General be of the same party and that the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general are elected as a slate, and so the winner of the primary in their designated party becomes the nominee to be voted for on in the general election and will serve as a team.
Okay. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill and then Representative Dahl.
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to go the elected route, which I'm more disposed not to, but at this point, but if we were to do that, and we want to assert the independence, I think that probably I would probably want to decouple him from that particular joint. So I'm going to vote against the amendment. I will remain open to discussion as it goes through the process, but at first blush, I would think if the assertion is we want an independent attorney general, then it should be, in fact, independent.
Okay. Attorney Dahl?
As in fact, I would simply say the same things. I also believe it would be should be nonpartisan.
Okay. Attorney Grunberg?
I'd like to associate myself with the comments of Representative Coghill.
Anybody else? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I struggle with this bill, and I, a little bit like Representative Rose's, a lot of the testimony that dissuaded me to not support the election of an attorney general didn't happen in this committee, but happened in resources, where we're dealing with what I think is going to be some future litigation. I think we're going to be in court quite a bit on that and the offshore development. And I think that with this amendment, I still don't know that I would even support the election of the Attorney General based upon that. Without this amendment, because of that alignment that I think we're going to need as a state to go forward against huge companies, big businesses that probably have a gross national, bigger than a gross national product of most countries. If we don't have that alignment, not only can I not support moving this bill, I'll oppose it. I mean, I think we have to have that alignment in the future. If we can't get at least this, I will certainly fall on the side of opposing the entire piece of legislation.
Representative Coghill?
He makes a very good case for why we should have an appointed attorney general. And I'm inclined to support that. But that's why I think you should have two very clear choices. Either you have an independent attorney general or you have a very strong governor. And under this condition, I will still oppose the amendment.
Yet, speaking from my own position on it, it would seem to me that if I were governor and attorney general, I'd like to have somebody at least in my same philosophical ballpark, not necessarily in lockstep with what I think, but at least in the same solve a ballpark, so I would support the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think my best move is to withdraw this amendment. I think I'd rather have a straight up and down vote on the bill without this to cloud it. And I think that what I'd like to an opportunity is to, you know, I tried to make it acceptable to myself to try to, you know, at least meet some middle ground. But I'd like to withdraw this and be very clear that I don't support the election of the Attorney General, and I don't want to cloud it with this amendment at this time. So I'd like to withdraw it.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time. Very quickly, because I would like to take action on this if we possibly can, and bells are going to be ringing in just a moment. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that I think there's a lot of merit to electing the Attorney General. However, I do think there should be term limits, and I would like to see this voted down without actually considering the question of term limits. I also did want to make a comment about democracy and this whole question of whether one has the best qualified candidate or the one who's best qualified to win. And I think that is something that we do in everything, in every public office. We're always looking for who is best qualified, but who can campaign and win. And this is no exception. This shouldn't be an exception to that. So therefore, I would like to stand by this this resolution. I'd like to see it put in front of the people. I would like to see the people vote on this. But I do believe that we can't really vote on this unless we have something to do with term limits.
Okay. We're going to have to cut it. Representative McCarver, did you have a quick wrap-up? No more than 1 minute?
Yes.
And I'd like to ask you what your desires are. Would you like to have us hold this to discuss it further? Would you like to have us take a vote now?
Chairman,
put it on your back.
I can see the handwriting on the wall. look down through history, you see through the history of Western civilization.
And if I might just bring it, this would go to Judiciary Committee next, and I personally would vote to send it to the Judiciary Committee. But go ahead, please.
Well, I'm at your pleasure, and if you decide to move it this morning, that'd be great. If you decide to kill this for another term, then I'll have to live with that as well.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I want to kill it. I think it should be reserved for further discussion. So either I could appeal to you to hold it or I could make a motion to table it. because I think there's still some legitimate discussion that could go on, and I don't know that we have time. We have between now and the end of next session to get it out so that it can go out before the public. And I would hate to see us just stop it here, because I think the discussion still is a very needed discussion. So I don't know that we have to be in a hurry just this session. And I think this is a good policy committee place to do it. So Mr. Chairman, I would just make the motion that we go ahead and table this for the present.
I think it's been a most fascinating and enlightening discussion, at least for me, because there's some real policy questions involved here. And as we have seen, we make a good case either way on this bill. It's been very educational for me, and I think everybody who's been listening, because there's no easy answer. So with the concurrence of the committee, I'm going to hold this, and
yeah, I'll withdraw my motion then.
What's that?
I'll withdraw my motion, because I made the motion to table it, but I'll withdraw that.
Okay. I'm going to hold this with the potential, very big potential, of bringing it up again either this session or maybe at the beginning of next session. And Representative Greenberg, and then we're going to...
I would like to make an offer to the chair and to Representative Crawford. This has exposed some potential issues here. I think we should consider whether there should be some legislation dealing with potential conflicts here that are unique to the Attorney General, and whether there should be a provision for the appointment of an Office of Governor's Council or something like that.
Okay.
And if you want to pursue that, I'm happy to.
Well, we'll consider that maybe during the interim. Yep. I want to thank everybody for this very, again, enlightening discussion. And I had wanted to pass it out, but I'd rather hold it in committee with the possibility of passing out at a later date. And I want to thank you for bringing this very important issue to us. Final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving us such a thorough hearing.
Thank you very much. With no other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:05, and thank you, everybody, for your participation. Patello.